Hello and welcome to this bonus episode of Pulp Kitchen, where we're going to be talking about the Oscars this year. We're going to be talking about something very interesting. We're going to do two things. The first is that we have ranked individually. James and I have looked at the Best Picture nominees at this year's Oscars, and we have ranked them in order from our least favorite to our most favorite. Not what we think should win, to clarify. It's like in order of pure preference, what we think are the best films and the least best films. We've done it individually.
We've seen them all now too.
We've seen all the, that's the thing. In honor of us seeing all of them, we've ranked them and we're going to discuss each other's lists. I think they'll be similar, but there's going to be points of difference.
Because to be honest, like my sort of, there's my middle zone, my sort of 3 to 7. A lot of the ones next to each other are splitting hairs. Like I can't, some of them are very different films. And some of them are just sort of trying to achieve completely different things and therefore ranking them is a little bit...
That zone is indeed
of interest. Yes. Totally, the zone of interest is... We talked about it in our review, which you can check out, which is like part sort of museum exhibition piece of cinema, but nonetheless incredibly powerful.
It's like a confronting artwork. Does it have a... It sits uncomfortably in a kind of spectator arena of cinema.
Completely separately, I hear Steve McQueen's 4-hour documentary Occupied City is brilliant in a similar capacity.
4.5-hour documentary.
Yes, about, which is why we haven't seen it. And I really do like Steve McQueen's work. He's directed one of my favourite films, but I'm like, I similarly would like to see that. Apparently it sits in a similar space.
I'm also going to be, after we've done that, I will be giving James a little test, a little pop quiz about the Oscars from 10 years ago, which we've played on the show every year now. It's like an inaugural thing, but we'll get to that. So let's talk about this year's Oscars then.
Okay.
We're going to go from least favorite to most favorite. There are 10 nominees this year.
Should we read out the nominees without no particular order?
In alphabetical
These are
order.
Just the nominees.
I have them written out. Do you have them written in alphabetical order?
I'm just going to read them as Google did.
I got them. In alphabetical order, the nominees are American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie, The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Past Lives, Poor Things, The Zone of Interest. James, that's 10 movies. At number 10, what did you put?
At number 10 for me, and I would assume yours is the same, is Maestro.
Correct.
We've talked about this many times when we reviewed it and also in emails. We don't really feel like the film got to the heart of who Leonard Bernstein was, despite having great performances. That scene where he conducts Mahler's symphony, beautiful. Yep. We actually had a conversation on our episode recently about, or someone wrote in about it not accurately communicating the stakes of music and how hard it is to conduct. I just sort of left it thinking he was gay and loved his wife, and that was it.
I really think Cooper unfortunately fails to connect an audience to why Bernstein was such a talent, why he was so intelligent.
Why make the film?
Yeah, why is he interesting? All it did was just add to the kind of mist around him. I believe it's a very sincere film. I believe in Cooper's love and adoration of Bernstein, but I don't know why. It's a gorgeous film. I love it for that, and I respect Bradley Cooper's heart and intent for it, but it really, really didn't land.
And at 2 hours in, I'm not so impressed with you sitting with your arms folded with heavy prosthetic and half-moon glasses mumbling through a cigarette.
The thing is about the music.
Do you have any questions? No, actually, I don't have any questions. I have no questions coming out of your film. I think he asked that, do you have any questions? Nope.
Because you didn't raise any questions.
You didn't raise any questions.
Okay, that's number 10. At number 9, I've got, I wonder if you think the same, American Fiction.
Me too. That's also my number 9. Parts of it I enjoyed. I didn't think it was sort of... Whereas I think Maestro ultimately kind of fails. I left American Fiction thinking this wasn't as much of a satire as I wanted it to be. Yeah. Again, we covered this in the episode. There's a sort of family drama that undercuts it, that doesn't... That just leaves me slightly misplaced as an audience viewer. I think there's definitely a satire that's sort of more meta than I think the film allows itself to communicate. And therefore, I'm left a little bit wanting.
I understand why the family drama is there. I'm okay with it being there, but my point is, if you're going to dedicate that much more time to family drama over what is already a very interesting concept with the satire, I would like that family drama to be more interesting.
And there are scenes in that film where I really did laugh, and I think like the satire on the publishing and the PR world, it is genuinely funny, and it really does feel like it's written from experience. But and there's a couple of interesting conversations in there, like when he speaks to the other black writer who he's just like
Issa Rae. That's a really good scene. I really like that. When they have the most depressing looking salad in that conference room.
Totally, like sad intellectuals like meet up to decide these like award ceremonies.
I know.
Yeah.
So number 8, moving up now. James,
I just want to say my jump. I know it's like hence the ranking system, but my jump up is substantial. So like I've got Maestro and American Fiction down here, and then the rest of my films, I'd say, sit a lot closer together.
Notch above.
So I've actually gone for Barbie.
Same.
As my number eight, because I really did enjoy Barbie, and I think it's really funny. I actually think the film is very brave, and I think what it pulls off and achieves is really incredible. I think the production design as well is unlike anything I've seen, or at least in my generation. We haven't seen films made that way. But I think, you know, I've seen it twice, 2.5 times when we watched it on Silent Interview. And I worry a little bit about Barbie, about it aging. I don't know why. Just the inherent satire of it feeling so modern and is funny to us. I worry that, I really hope Barbie in 1 year is really fun to put on and watch and isn't a bit of like, I'm going back to watch something versus like, oh, it's really fun to watch Barbie. I can't quite read the tea leaves on that yet. If it is fun to rewatch in a year or two's time, I think I'll consider it to be more of a success.
Yeah, I know. Now. Well, as everything, time tells. I think I like Barbie. I respect it. I like lots of it. I really like what Greta Gerwig was trying to do, and parts of it I really enjoy. Some of it still feels like slightly dysfunctional to me. Like I can't quite cling into it as a functional movie. It's very lots of bits that I really enjoy. I do accept that, you know, it is also like we're not the target audience in the sense that we are in the sense that it's for everyone, and I did enjoy it. But like I also know basically most of the women I know really really liked it and thought it was really smart and funny, and I'm like, well, that's also key.
Yeah.
And I do think Ryan Gosling is doing a good performance, but it's not. I commend the film and I respect it. I'm almost a little bit surprised to see it be so heavily represented in kind of the awards season.
Sure.
That it's been included so much. I guess when you've had that much of a tearaway success financially, Sirens on Her End, you'll get included in Best Picture. Like Top Gun Maverick was the name for Best Picture. That's fine.
Yeah.
But I'm always I think it's fine.
Well, I'm really glad that, you know, we do this weekly podcast and we cover films every week. That nothing will ever take away what it did in terms of bringing people together and bringing people to the cinema, bringing women to the cinema. Like many of my female friends will say, I feel like every single film out there is marketed towards a 14-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. There's so few interesting films that feel like they're written from a female perspective. And just like the fact, the number of people that were talking about Barbie in conjunction with Oppenheimer, I'm so glad we experienced that and covered it and it was part of history. And I really just feel like that will never be taken away from that film and what it did. And like the power of cinema and experiencing it with friends, even though you and I on every episode are like, you should go alone. Don't go with anyone in cinema. Like that was a very, very special moment in time.
Also, Barbie did make me laugh out loud quite a few times.
Yes, so it really did. It really, really did.
Okay, so number 7 now.
What have you got?
I've gone for what I call X-rated Barbie, which is Poor Things.
Right, okay. So Poor Things I've got next.
Okay.
But between that, I've got The Holdovers.
Right, okay. So I put Poor Things here because Poor Things in a way like gives me everything that Barbie does in a slightly punkier, more uncomfortable fashion. And I just adored the production. The production design in Barbie is amazing, but the production design in particular of Poor Things is great. A little bit too long.
The Lisbon sequence in particular.
But I also. The performances I think were more pronounced in Poor Things than they were in something like Barbie. Not that the performances were bad in Barbie.
No.
But my thing is like in Barbie, Margot Robbie's it's doing a perfectly fine performance, but Barbie actually I don't think is that inherently as interesting a character as Bella Baxter is in Poor Things. So I liked the disconnect. I was going to say,
both of them are sort of like a grown-up woman achieving self-realization, confronting the patriarchy in many different forms.
Yeah.
It's actually funny how similar they are, but with completely different style and tone.
Yeah,
both sort of, I think, successful as films.
So you've put The Holdovers.
I've actually come next with The Holdovers. Again, a film I really, really liked. I actually was recommending it to some people the other day, and I described it as this film that really feels like out of time, both in the style of the film and how it literally, with indents and its grainy texture, makes you feel like you're watching a film. And if you miss those types of films, it's definitely worth seeing. Really great performances. The actor who makes his debut in it.
Dominic Sessa.
Brilliant. I think he's really good in it, and nothing about it felt cheap. The emotional punches weren't cheesy to me and they felt really well earned, so The Holdovers sits comfortably over there.
Number 6 is You Have Poor Things.
Yes.
Do you have anything to add?
I've already covered Poor Things.
Well, I actually, for number 6, I've put The Zone of Interest.
Right.
The reason I put The Zone of Interest at number 6, and again we're talking about the jump, I recognise there is a jump between The Poor Things to The Zone of Interest.
Yes, I'd say so too.
Zone of Interest not above. The reason The Zone of Interest is only at 6 and not above is because I think that it, like we say, it's almost limited by its mastery sometimes. And I'm wondering, I could put the Zone of Interest almost at number one for its power,
totally,
and its execution, and its impact, and its brilliance, artistic brilliance of it. But I also, I wonder, I'm also thinking about my future engagement with it, which is very bad because I'm talking about film as like a commodity then. And this is why the Zone of Interest sits uncomfortably in that, because it is like an exhibition piece. Zone of Interest is probably a film I'll watch every 10 years, once every 10 years. But I won't
like Schindler's List, really.
Yeah, but I won't watch any in the shorter gaps. Whereas the film I have after this, at number five, I put above the Zone of Interest just because of its rewatchability.
Totally.
So what about you for number...
Just commenting on Zone of Interest while you're on it, because it sits a little bit higher for me, but... Zone of Interest is a film. Some people have asked me recently, what's good? What's good that's out? And I've said, the Zone of Interest is phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily recommend it if you're not in the right headspace or right frame of mind. And I talk about it being this, it feels like an exhibition piece. And it's an experience in the cinema I've not had in a very long time, which for me and you, I think is a really powerful thing to say. But I'm almost like, go and see it, challenge yourself.
Yes.
But it's not this sort of like, here's a story, here's a character. Like the people in that film are used as tools, the setting are used as tools to really make a fantastic commentary on complicity. So I agree. It's a weird one. It's how do you compare the Zone of Interest with Poor Things?
I mean,
so rank them.
So my number five, we're on to number five, aren't we?
Yeah, should I reveal mine? Because my next one is, number five.
Well, no, I was just going to say, so my number five is The Holdovers.
Right,
which covered. And the reason I just put that just above the Zone of Interest, when I said rewatchability, that's a film I can see myself returning to. And I know it seems a little bit like... The Holdovers is very safe.
Yeah.
The Zone of Interest is much more... And I probably, ask me this question in 2 hours and I could easily switch them around again. Mm. The Zone of Interest is penetrative and like it gets you in and like wakes you up. But The Holdovers is safer, and you can argue that. But I do think that I think I would return to that film more often. And there's something about how... I just really like that film. On paper, is very familiar and in a bit almost like cliche, and it elevates. It just removes any cliches out of that story and elevates it well above that into a really crafted, wholesome but not gritty piece.
So next up, like I've got obviously Zone of Interest.
This is your number five.
My number five is Oppenheimer, and like sort of it's, I have a similar jump for you where I regard these next five films as the best five films of the year. Oppenheimer. Again, I have told you, so many people have told me they either love Oppenheimer and think it's the film of the year and Nolan's genius, and the other half of them have said, can't stand that film, how he's terrible at writing women, it's confusing, it's overly long and boring and overly dense. I do like the film. I think it's brilliant. My second time watching it, I had this overwhelming feeling of like, that's such a wonderful love letter to science. Nolan clearly adores science and discovery in that period of history. And I actually love the post-bomb section. I think it's one of the most sort of like, brilliantly crafted examinations of what happened to this man. I do think it is probably rushed and spoke and said too quickly, and your comment on it not having enough time to breathe is definitely true. But when that film wraps up, what it manages to achieve in its 3-hour runtime, I think is phenomenally impressive. And you put that together with exceptional cinematography from Hoyt van Hoytma, an incredible, I think now iconic score from Ludwig Göransson, performance from Cillian Murphy and Robert Downey Jr., that film is really quite impressive.
So Oppenheimer is not yet for me, and I will get to it. But what I will say is, what's interesting is you and I have both seen it twice, but you saw it about 3 weeks after you saw it.
Yeah, within that,
3 weeks.
Like that.
Each other. I saw it 6 months after I originally seen it. I think that does make a difference.
Totally,
actually.
Yeah.
So what are we on now? So that's your number five, is it?
Yeah, and then my four is Zone of Interest, which we've talked about.
Oh, okay. Well, my four is actually, and again, ask me this question in 2 hours, I could easily change them. Yeah. It's actually Anatomy of a Fall.
Yeah.
And the reason Anatomy of a Fall, in a way, actually, I didn't really have anything more to add to Anatomy before. You've heard us talk about it on the main show. We love it very much. It's dense, it's knotty. Can't wait to rewatch it. Again, there's a jump between The Holdovers to Anatomy of a Fall. Mm. The Anatomy of a Fall, as you know, we talked about at the end of last year, one of our favorite films of last year.
Yeah.
Great. Loved it. Don't have anything more to say about it. Number four, yeah.
Yeah. Number four for me, I have The Zone of Interest, which we've discussed. My number three, which could easily switch with these two, is Killers of the Flower Moon.
Right.
What a film.
Yeah.
What a story. Felt so essential. Performances from an incredible cast. I love Jesse Plemons in anything.
Oh yeah, yeah. I love Killers of the Flower Moon. My number three
It's my best director pick.
Oh yeah.
I think the direction of that film, distinctly from Martin Scorsese, is showing the master at work, showing the most experienced and capable director taking a very complicated, difficult story over a very long runtime.
So my number three is actually Oppenheimer, and that's really climbed up the rankings for me. And I didn't talk about this on the show unless I might have touched upon it briefly when we spoke with James Raiders of the Lost podcast. I rewatched Oppenheimer at Christmas,
yeah.
And I rewatched it with subtitles on. And I, you know, I talked about jealous. When we did, yeah, when we did. That's why I said your second viewing was still at the cinema.
Still cinema.
And when we reviewed Killers of the Flower Moon, I said you kind of got to do a home and away situation.
Yes,
you've yeah, played yeah. away. You go on, you do it on Scorsese's terms. You watch it all in the cinema, the yeah. 3.5 hours cut, and then you do it the home play it on your home turf. You watch it at home, and
I
watched it at home, and I can tell you right now, there is literally a moment of black at the 1 and 2 hour mark in Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
That you can definitively stop it and have a little break and then come back to it. Yeah. I know that's not what Nolan is intending,
no.
but I'm saying it actually cuts almost to the minute very cleanly to wow. stop on the hour. Having done that, having watched it at home, having done it with my own breaking down, with a very respectful audience of my mum and my brother.
Yeah. Who had also seen it?
No, only my mum had seen it, but my brother hadn't. And right. within half an hour, my brother said to me, "This is Nolan's best film."
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
And watching it with subtitles was immeasurably helpful. 100%. Not, I think tipped me over into understanding and really being open to that film.
Yeah.
I learned so much from it. I really almost want to look at the script now, and it was. Like I said, it just tips the dial, and having read it with the subtitles and having given it the breaks, I really properly understand it. And yesterday I watched the BAFTAs, and they obviously Oppenheimer did very well, and they're yeah. showing clips of it. And I honestly had a moment where I thought, oh, you know, I genuinely think that on my third viewing of Oppenheimer, I could really rate it very highly.
It's interesting because you came out the first time and you did struggle yeah. with it a little bit.
But I'm realizing for a film that is knotty and dense, I'm starting to unravel the layers through repeated viewing of what Nolan was attempting to do and what Nolan is doing on screen. And I'm starting to realize like, oh, actually, I think this could be like really brilliant. And I'm someone I like to... I'm quite reserved in my judgment in a sense that I, and anyone who follows me on Letterboxd will know this, that I never give a film really 5 stars on the first viewing. I'm just not right. that, I'm just quite reserved like that. I always think a second viewing is crucial.
True.
And I now, with being exposed to Oppenheimer more and more, I'm edging close to thinking this is actually something quite good. So previously, before I watched it for the second time, whenever people talked about Oppenheimer, I would always go, yeah, and felt a little bit conflicted. And now I go, yeah, no, I can see now. I really can see what people thought about this.
Have you had a second look at Florence Pugh's scenes? Are you still struggling with those?
No, I was okay with those. And I felt better about the Emily Blunt scenes, actually. It all.
You said in your first review that you said Oppenheimer didn't know how to write women in the scene when...
You mean Nolan didn't know how to write women.
Sorry, no, Nolan didn't know how to write women.
No, I said...
When she's naked in the deposition.
Yeah, that is a little distracting.
You did say that you'd struggle with that.
In the first time I watched it.
Yeah.
And now I don't feel as bad with that.
Right, okay. Yeah, so I still find that scene a little bit weird.
The naked humping in the meeting room is a little bit distracting. yeah. I'll agree with that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do agree, it doesn't help that Nolan has written a lot of unhappy alcoholic wives, of which Emily Blunt is one and kind of Florence Pugh as well. However, I think, I don't know, it just worked. I know you talked about that, you didn't like that scene where she smashes the thing. That actually, on my second viewing, made more sense.
Right.
Because I'd read what she was saying. I understood how it connected to previous things.
Yeah.
This is my point. It kind of all makes more... I can almost feel the...
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood effect, where it's sort of soaking into it a little bit more.
I can almost hear the music building up with the bum, 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 the Oppenheimer sound as I understand the movie better. But anyway, that's my number three.
Can you hear the music?
James, number two...
Number two is Anatomy of a Fall, which we've discussed. Love it. Its stickiness to me, the way in which it grabbed hold of me and let me go. I'll never listen to 50 Cent in the same way ever again. Best canine unit acting Oscar
Absolutely.
Goes to. I thought the kid was brilliant. Yeah. Sandra Hüller is now one of my favorite actors I'll look out for from seeing her in Zone of Interest and Anatomy of a Fall. She's like just like horrifyingly real and... Yeah. sincere and impenetrable in that film. I never really, considering how much she talks and how much she tries to explain herself, she's just never, you never really get a sense of what exactly she's thinking, and that's part of the film's genius.
I agree with everything you're saying. My number two is Killers of the Flower Moon. Could be higher, but it's crucial with a lot of these films I've only seen, except for, I've only seen Barbie and Oppenheimer twice, you see? And that second viewing affects everything. But I think Killers of the Flower Moon, upon rewatch, could also lend itself more like Barbie.
I can't wait to rewatch Killers.
But I agree with everything you said about Killers of the Flower Moon. I agree. Which brings us to number one. What's our number one, James?
Past Lives.
Absolutely. And I think the hard thing with Past Lives is that in a list where you have big heavyweight films like Oppenheimer and Killers of the Flower Moon, I sometimes think it makes past lives that look quite like a little delicate flower, dwarfed by the shadows of these two giants. But actually, that makes me like it more.
I've only seen past lives once. Having had distance from it now, I think there's almost, because that film is so softly spoken, I'm starting to not forget it, but it's fading in my memory. Whereas the bombastic Oppenheimer, and even Zone of Interest, if you consider it sound design, which is fresh, they lay very fresh in my eyes. And I am trying to remember, like, no, that film was really special, what it does without dialogue and what it does with restraint. I saw this really interesting interview where Greta Lee was talking about how she didn't let the two leads touch ever until that moment.
Celine Song.
Yeah, Celine Song didn't let the two leads touch each other until that final moment when they shot it. Because there's a moment where they touch.
Is that on the tube, is it?
No, I think it's on the at the end. Oh, okay. And I'm like, what a sort of impactful thing. I can't wait to rewatch that scene with that knowledge in mind.
My parents went to a 10:30 screening at the local cinema that's not a good story if it's in the morning. Yeah, 10:30 at night screening, because on my recommendation, and they were the only people there. And my dad usually struggles with subtitles movies, in that he's ignorant and doesn't try. But he got on with it very well. They both really liked it.
It's on Netflix now.
Because it's a big old romantic movie. That's why it's an emotional one.
What's a great film? I go, have you seen Past Lives? And they go, no. And I go, let me know when you've seen it.
Were our rankings for this year's
mostly
Oscars.
Similar with a sort of middle bits flipping around there, but yeah,
we kind of, but there's a Pulp Kitchen consensus.
It's almost like we talk about these things every week.
But can we play a game?
Oh my God, okay.
Okay, so this is a game. It's not going to be a fast one. I'm going to give you time to think about it. Yep. We've played this the past 2 years.
Okay.
Which is, there's all this talk about films coming out. Mm-hmm. And one thing that often happens and has happened in recent years is that films get a lot of attention at the awards cycle and then they drift away and fade away, never again, never to be thought of again. I do think that might happen with something like American Fiction, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But anyway, I thought, well, why not cast our minds back 10 years ago to the 2014 Oscars?
Which George told me about this, like, just before we started. I've not looked
James
at it.
James had no time to prepare.
I wouldn't cheat.
You know, recognizing the best films from 2013.
Yes, so it's 2013.
Let's see how many films that you can remember. Let me tell you, James, there's not 10. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 nominees.
9 films. Okay.
That came out in 2013. Can you tell me? Can you guess?
My first guess for this is that we are peak reconnaissance. So this will be the Dallas Buyers Club year.
Correct.
Which means that DiCaprio lost to him for Wolf of Wall Street.
Correct.
Right. I'm on fire.
Two
okay,
down.
Okay, so next up, 2013. Did Gravity get nominated?
It did. Well done.
Okay. So Gravity got nominated for Best Picture. Interstellar didn't get nominated for Best Picture.
Not like, you're too early.
Too early.
And it didn't, I don't think, anyway.
So who else was around during that time? I'm going to say 2013.
You've actually already referred to this film.
12 Years a Slave.
Correct.
12 Years a Slave, which won Best Picture.
Which won Best Picture.
Then we got 2013. So I was leaving school. I was at uni by this time.
Yep.
So I'm going to guess...
First term at uni.
Too soon for Whiplash.
Yep.
Okay, what about Her?
Correct.
Her's
well
nominated.
Yeah, Joaquin Phoenix.
Okay.
Yep.
Great poster, red with the face and that brilliant
great
moustache.
Great production design as well.
Yeah, beautiful. And Chris Pratt was in that film.
Yes.
So I said Gravity, I said Her, I've said...
So far you have 12 Years a Slave, Dallas Buyers Club, Gravity, Her, and The Wolf of Wall Street. So you have 1, 2, 3, 4 nominees left.
Can I get a clue?
One of these nominees... is two words, the first word of which is also the first word of one of the nominees for this year's category, for the Best Pictures nominees. Of the 2024 nominees, there's one movie that's two words, and the first word of that movie... No, okay. The first word of that, the name of that film is also the first word of a name of one of the films from 10 years ago.
It's really,
maybe I've just sent you down the wrong path.
You've got others.
You've seen all of them.
Captain Phillips.
Yes, that is another one. That's not the one. There's no film. No. Captain's Zone of Interest.
Yeah, I remember Captain Phillips. I remember what's his face got nominated.
Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well done.
Okay.
You've got three left.
Let's go for. I don't think I have this.
You've definitely seen them, I think.
Yeah.
One of them is by a director who has a film in this year's Best Picture category.
Not Scorsese, which would count. Oppenheimer. Is it Lanthimos? Has it Lanthimos got one? Is it? Can you give me a cast net member for one?
Okay, of the three left. I mean, one's got loads of famous people. One of them also, right.
I'm going to give you this.
So one of the films, the one I was trying to say had the same first letter. Let me do that again. One of those films has an actor in it in, I would say, the third role or the second role of the movie. You know, not the top, not the lead role.
Yeah.
I'd probably say the second lead role or the third lead role.
Yeah.
Is heavily involved in one of the nominees from this year. Big time. In a big way. So one of the actors,
yeah,
from 10 years ago,
yeah,
has made and is heavily involved in.
Oh, so we've got Bradley Cooper in here. For American Hustle.
Well done. American Hustle, American Fiction is what I was trying to do.
Of course.
He's got the perm, Hustle. Remember?
David O. Russell. American Hustle from David O. Russell. We've got two more. Is it like Philomena or something?
Yes, is it actually exactly Philomena? Well done.
Okay.
I was going to say to you, it's going to be like British National Treasure. So you've got one more.
Who's the co-star on Philomena again?
Steve Coogan.
No, the co-star. I know Steve Coogan's in it.
Judy Dench. That was the British National Treasure. I mean, yes. Steve Coogan's great.
Okay, great. So I've got one more.
You've got one more, and it's directed by one of the directors who also has a film in this year's Best Picture category, which is, I would say, midway through your list.
It's Alexander Payne.
It is an Alexander Payne movie from 10 years ago.
Descendants.
No, later.
No, Alexander Payne.
It's, I mean, I don't know if you did, maybe you didn't see. Okay, it's all in black and white. Cast includes Will Fort.
Have I seen this? I don't know if I've seen this.
Bob Odenkirk, June Squibb.
No, I've not seen this.
Bruce Dern.
No, go on.
Nebraska.
Oh, Nebraska.
Have you seen it?
No.
That's just the one thing you haven't seen. Yeah. Yeah, no, okay. Not an overly memorable Alexander Payne movie.
Nebraska. Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Let me, so again,
I've never guessed that.
12 Years a Slave, American Hustle, Captain Phillips, Dallas Buyers Club, Gravity, Her, Nebraska, Philomena, The Wolf of Wall Street.
Philomena was a good show.
It was a good show. I, broadly speaking, like all of the... No, actually, American Hustle I thought was overrated.
Oh, load of nonsense. Just like
Nebraska I have forgotten entirely, and Her, to be honest with you, I've only seen once and forgotten that. Gravity I thought was great in the cinema. I'm not sure it would hold up on home viewing. Philomena I really liked. I thought it was quite emotional. Wolf of Wall Street is, I know it's iconic and it sounds very film bro-y, but it is really good.
It's very good.
Brilliant. Dallas Buyers Club, I liked. I liked it in the cinema. I liked his performance.
I had a second appreciation for Captain Phillips when I watched it the second time.
Oh, yeah, I loved that, yeah.
Brilliant. Really,
and
really good.
12 Years a Slave for me was a bit of a Once Upon a Time in Hollywood thing because I saw it at the cinema, I thought it was fine. And then you, when we tried to do this podcast 8 years ago, you told me, you said, are we going to do 12 Years a Slave? And I said, okay. And I went and rewatched it.
It's brilliant.
Great. Yeah, it is a brilliant film.
It's so brilliant. Fassbender in that. Chiwetel. Distracting Brad Pitt cameo.
White Savior.
And Paul Dano is fantastic. Dano. Being very Paul Dano.
Oh, God.
Oh, repent for yourself.
And then also Benedict Cumberbatch doing his Alan Rickman in Die Hard accent. Oh God, you gotta get out of here, aren't you? Anyway, that was a bit of an Oscar.
It's between Wolf of Wall Street and 12 Years a Slave for me for Best Picture.
Yeah.
Dallas Buyers Club, I think, incredible performance. The film is, I think, is very good. I don't consider it like exceptional.
No, it's not exceptional filmmaking.
Her is brilliant as a sort of piece of like covering tech from 10 years ago. I think that film's gonna get more and more relevant.
I think men have started to dress like Joaquin Phoenix and
then with the moustache
and the high waist trousers as well.
You went down sort of Hackney Market on a Sunday afternoon.
Do you know why the Scarlett Johansson robot in that is called Samantha? It's because she was originally played by Samantha Morton, voice of Samantha Morton, and they just said I don't know why. Samantha Morton's a fantastic actor, but like just wasn't working, so they replaced it with Scarlett Johansson.
Scarlett Johansson's got a great voice.
Hi there. I mean, that's not her. That's me.
Yeah.
Anyway, those were the Oscars. That was sort of a 10-year over and out Oscars roundup there.
Yeah, that was great. Guys, thank you so much for listening to this bonus episode. We hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget, we post new episodes of the show every single Wednesday. We just did an episode on Madam Web and One Love, Bob Marley. Bob Marley, One Love.
I kept thinking it's One Life. It's definitely One Love, isn't it? Have I introduced it the wrong way? It's definitely...
Bob Marley, One Love. Yeah. On Google, it has a colon.
Yeah, so if you haven't checked that episode out, go check it out. And if not, we'll see you for episode 117 next week.
Bye, guys.
Bye.